Okay. Let's talk about kippahs. Yarmulke politics, basketball, and Jewish identity in America. So this is going to be what we're going to discuss today is a case study which takes place in Chicago, Illinois. And it becomes a lens. This is again, one need not be terribly conversant in LeBron James and Steph Curry and Michael Jordan to really understand the components of what we're talking about. But we do have to understand the yarmulke. In an oral history about his time in the 20s at the Hebrew Theological College, which maybe even before I get there, in the 20s, it was really assumed, especially with migration from Europe being shrunk to just a trickle through legislation in 1924. It's really presumed that if Orthodox Judaism is going to survive, if it's going to flourish in the United States, it's going to come about because of two institutions, the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, otherwise known as the Yeshiva. There was no Yeshiva College until 1928. And the other was Hebrew Theological College, known as the Yeshiva, in Chicago. There were other yeshivas, but none were as promising as these two. They actually held inter-yeshiva debates in Chicago and in New York, and they were covered in the press. They were both the founding institutions that would create, along with the Orthodox Union, the Rabbinical Council of America. Now called colloquially the Skokie Yeshiva, it no longer has a robust rabbinical program, but in its time, certainly was very, very important. Leonard Mishkin, who was a very able historian and teacher, people in Chicago remember him quite fondly. He sat down for an oral history here, dated 1978, and recalling his time at the Yeshiva. The only time we put on a kippah in the university, referring to University of Chicago, where many students learned actually in the morning. They would take college class in the morning and they would go to Hebrew Theological College on the west side of Chicago in the afternoon. The only time we put on a kippah in the university in those days was when we had our lunches. We could go to a corner of a room, put on kippot, wash, eat, etc. The students in the HTC, again, Hebrew Theological College, read all the latest novels, literature, magazine, etc. On the weekends, we used to go to the public library and take out books such as Klinkwater's Outline of Literature, Thompson's Outline of Science. In those days, they were the most current. We would come back to the yeshiva and discuss them. It's interesting, the role of the yarmulke. A kippah was something that you put on when you daven and when you ate. It wasn't an ideological statement, and we learned. It wasn't an ideological statement that somehow we're going to just barely countenance college learning, so we won't wear a yarmulke to show that it has no Jewish value. It was just not something you did. In fact, in Germany, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, in his school in Frankfurt, his day school, prohibited, not just made it optional, prohibited his boy male students. Young boys wearing kippahs, studying general studies. You did not go. You went bareheaded because that was polite way of doing things. You did not wear a hat. Did not wear a yarmulke indoors. Famously, I know the historians have challenged this quite a bit. Is that the first person who changed that was John F. Kennedy in his comportment about when and where to wear hats. But until then. It was perceived that gentlemanly conduct was that you wore a hat when you were outdoors, and you certainly were bareheaded indoors. Why wear a yarmulke? Things start to change by the 1950s. Here is Rabbi Joseph or Rabbi Yosef Weiss, an article, and then in the OU Jewish Life magazine, in which he pushes in the post-war period, you gotta wear a yarmulke. One of the most repeated and best-loved Jewish traditions is to cover our head at all times, in all places, and on every occasion. Rabbi Joseph Weiss was actually one of the leading students of Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, and was for a long time a Rosh Yeshiva. Was a delivered a Talmud lecture every a shiur, I think every day. At YU and Yeshiva University. But what's the actual halacha? So, if you take a look in Shulchan Aruch, Asur Leilech B'Koma Zekufa, it is forbidden to walk in an overly haughty, upright posture. V'lo Yeilech Dalet Amot B'Gilei Rosh. And you shouldn't walk a distance of 4 amot, 6 to 8 feet, bareheaded. All right. And if you take a look though at the Darchei Moshe, which is the commentary of the Ramah, the Katav HaKolbo, B'Shem HaRam, cites the Kolbo name of the Ram is Meram Rodenberg, De'inu Asar Leilech B'Gilei Rosh. So while the Shulchan Aruch Rabbi Yosef Cairo, who of course comes from a Sephardic tradition, suggested that you have to wear a, you have to be, men have to have their heads covered at all times. The Darchei Moshe, marshals the Ashkenazic position where it's not so. De'inu Asar Leilech B'Gilei Rosh, ki zeh haya midat chasidut. It's nice, but you don't need to. And he quotes the member of the Balei Tosfos, Rabbeinu Peretz, Katav she'asur leilech b'gilei rosh l'beit ha'knesset. But it is true that in shul, one should not, a man should not go bareheaded. He quotes the Mahari, Siman Reish Gimel, Katav amash shal tzam. So he talks about a particular interesting case about going covered, which we'll just pass over for a moment. Omnam, however, I'm in the third line. Beit Yosef Lekaman, so he quotes the Beit Yosef, who of course, actually, of course, is the same author of the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Cairo, that he says it's also, but real, but truly the Ashkenazic tradition is not so. One does not need to be had their head covered at all times, but only during during prayer and while eating and learning. Now, oh, good. Talked about the seminary a little bit before before we put up the slides. So this is, of course, Saul Lieberman, who apparently didn't read, apropos we learned is that didn't just do Purim Torah, but also believed in Hanukkah Torah, whatever that's worth. Anyway, in the 1950s, so same time as Joseph Weiss is writing, something interesting happens. The air conditioning breaks in the Capitol. What? Yeah, so the air conditioning breaks in the Capitol area, and the government needs to install a new one. So they figure, you know, it's all happened to us. You need to fix the kitchen sink. So all of a sudden, you remodel the entire kitchen. You need to replace a shower cap, and all of a sudden, you have a new master bath. Same thing, in apparently in the federal government, is that when they needed to replace the air conditioning system in 1950. What happened was that Congress decided that they were going to remodel and to place a series of what they called lawgivers in the chamber, in the House chamber, which is there today. And it has, it's interesting, is the there's an article to be written about the selection process and who they asked scholars from University of Pennsylvania, quite interestingly, and they asked some other people, but they then eventually bidded it out to various sculpture artists after they selected, did Congress, about who would be the so-called lawgivers. It's interesting. They chose, they didn't choose Jesus or Muhammad because they were faith givers, not lawgivers. I think Jesus certainly is not included. Madison was included. Jefferson is included. Cicero was included. The two bona fide Jews are included is Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, and Maimonides. And here on the left is Maimonides and Brenda Putnam, whose father was one of the leaders of the Smithsonian, but she in her own right was a very important sculpture artist at that time, was unsure about how to depict Maimonides. And to help her solve that quagmire, she had phoned Professor Saul Lieberman of the Jewish Theological Seminary and then wrote a follow-up letter to him. So, make it a little bit bigger so we can see it. It has been, you'll see why this has to do with yarmulkes, and not just because Lieberman had a very big one. It has been so long since you kindly helped me last September, to some of, to sort, to, excuse me, to some sort of concept of the physical attributes of Maimonides that I think I should introduce myself all over again. So we spoke a long time ago, Professor Lieberman. You, when I asked about what the heck does Maimonides, should he look like? We don't have a picture of Maimonides. I need your help. She had been successful bidder for two different sculptures. One was Salon. And if you look to the fourth paragraph, having finished Salon, I have now begun Maimonides. And I'm wondering, see my cursor over here, if you are still as firm as ever in your conviction that if the turban be abandoned, so there was pressure in the 1950s, sort of an anti-Islamicism to not depict Maimonides in some sort of turban headdress. He should not wear any sort of head covering or small cap, such as you and your colleagues wear. So he said, so in other words, if I'm receiving pressure not to place a turban on top of Maimonides' heads, I would very much like to put a kippah on him, a small cap. I should so very much like to give him one, even though such things were prescribed long after the 12th century. Maimonides lived from 1138 to 1204. Aside from Moses, who will be depicted front view, so Maimonides was the side, so there was an artistic purpose to this. Maimonides is the only great Hebrew scholar in the group, and I should like to add this small, recognizable insignia, not only because it adds distinction and a decorative line to the design, so there's value in complicating the top of the bust of the image of Maimonides from an artistic point of view. It shouldn't just be blank, but because it would make him the more readily identifiable to the thousands of visitors in the galleries. She wanted to put a yarmulke on Maimonides so that everybody who came and visited the house chamber would know that this was a Jewish scholar. So my question is, would it be possible, if not probable? I wish I could bring the plaque to you for inspection, but alas, so she goes on forth, she lost her phone number, but essentially, and of course, if you take a look, Maimonides, she ends up going with the turban look. But you see in 1950 already, we are way past the testimony of Leonard Mishkin about Hebrew, about the Chicago boys at Hebrew Theological College. Certainly, we see that Rabbi Yosef Weiss and others are pushing people to wear yarmulkes, the first tshuva and Igros Moshe, and Moshe Feinstein's responses about actually wearing a yarmulke, which is important. But here, an outsider, Brenda Putnam, not Jewish, is petitioning Saul Lieberman. Is it possible? Not probable. Is it possible? Because I so badly want to put a yarmulke on his head, because the expectation is that Jewish men wear yarmulkes by the 1950s. By 1971, Rabbi Norman Lamb delivering a sermon at the Jewish Center. If Larry Kobrin, who's joined us, I think, if he's here, he'll be able to talk about this better than I. But it's actually, I believe, his mother and his parents who are responsible for this very rich collection, because they asked that Rabbi Lamb write up present his sermons. I think if I recall correctly, Larry once shared with me that Rabbi Lamb didn't write them up. He had notes, but he would write them up Motzei Shabbat, Saturday night, so that for his congregants, particularly the Kobrins. And that's why we have Rabbi Lamb's drasha. They're invaluable to the state. It's full of just amazing information. Here's just a snippet from 1971, post Six-Day War, and that's the important point. I became strikingly aware of this quote recently in a discussion I had with the most intelligent young couple in the process of deciding about a day school for their child. One of the problems they raised was whether the child would be taught to wear his kippah or cap outside of school in the streets. Let me make it clear that I am not now concerned about the din, Shulchan Aruch versus the Darchei Moshe, about Jewish law. Strictly speaking, the law is quite lenient in this respect. What is important is the kippah as a psycho-cultural symbol. In my generation, he was born in 1928, so the generation after we saw from Leonard Mishkin, even the most pious did not wear the kippah in museums or libraries and theaters or universities or public places. And we impose our standards upon our children. We do not relish the kippah as a sign of our differentness.
we want to avoid the sneer or the smirk of the socially superior, quote unquote, American. We do not want to stand out too much. We want to keep our religion and our practices in our homes and not make it too blatant and too demonstrative. But this is the very reason that today's youth, not necessarily for religious reasons at all, insist upon wearing a kippah every place. Places public and private, streets or homes, museums or libraries or movies, or whatever it might be. They are saying, identity. This is again post Six-Day War, which is really important about Jewish identity. This flooring of emotion about Israel pride and Jewish pride. This is my identity. Whether you like it or not, I am who I am and I shall not be someone else in order to please you. The kippah represents to me, obviously for men, what I am in my eyes. I could not care less what it means to you in your eyes. I will respect you. I will be considerate of you. I will help you, but I will not modify my being and change my character and curb my own identity in order to satisfy standards that you think proper, but which I reject. I should also say is that this is one of the reasons why, particularly at this time, that in the conservative and reform movements, more and more women wouldn't have women rabbis until 73. So this predates that, but that's why you have many people, men and women in non-Orthodox circles wearing yarmulkes in synagogue, but certainly men in Rabbi Lamb's world, in the Orthodox world, are wearing kippahs, not because it's the Jewish law per se. You can find a kula. There are leniencies. They abound. And in fact, it was de jure. But by 1971, everybody, because it was the cool thing to do, wore a kippah. Jewish exponent. 1978, the yarmulke, here to stay, but always changing. A feature article about when all of a sudden folks testifying also in the 1970s, once everybody started wearing yarmulkes. So the question was, what type of yarmulke? Was it a crochet yarmulke? Was it a velvet yarmulke? Once you started wearing yarmulkes, they were political statements about what type of thing. It represented your Zionism, your non-Zionism, your anti-Zionism. And all of a sudden, but because yarmulkes became a staple for male headdress, all of a sudden, now the type of yarmulke mattered quite a bit. Now that's the background to understand what happens in 1981. Let me move my Zoom control so I can read it to you. At the Hebrew Theological College's high school division, we'll just call it the Skokie Yeshiva. By then, they had moved from the west side in the late 50s to the northern suburbs, to Skokie, Illinois, just outside of Chicago proper. The senior varsity started out this year with many high expectations, but unfortunately, their playing didn't fulfill its potential. The season started out well, with a preseason tournament victory over the Academy. That's Ida Crown Jewish Academy. They had never beat. That was their rival school to that time. The school was founded in 62, so that they had finally started. They didn't have a basketball team initially. They were finally able to topple their rival, and an away victory over St. Vincent. Senior captains Howie Singer and Shalom Menorah played important roles in helping the team mature, and both captains played experienced ball on the court. With the return of the outstanding juniors to the squad next year, the team should have much success. Okay. A pretty benign caption in the high school yearbook that the team had high expectations. Luckily, they have a junior class that's going to rise into seniors. They're going to be even bigger and better next year in 1982. It didn't live up to the hype, but they beat the Academy after all. Harvard says the same thing about Yale. Look at Ida Crown's yearbook from the same year. One big season highlight was the Illinois High School Association's regional basketball tournament, when our varsity team almost did not play due to the fact that they wear kippot. Rabbi Blanchard, principal of the academy, along with some top people from the yeshiva, took the Illinois High School Association, the basketball association, to court and received a temporary restraining order on the association's limitation. The association claimed that the kippah could fall to the floor and cause a player to slip, or a bobby pin could stick someone in the eye. The alleged quote-unquote rule was never enforced by a referee during any previous season, though, and never has a kippah been the cause of a player's injury. In the end, just gonna move the zoom controls. The teams lost the battles on the court, but won their war in the court. Not on the court, but in the court. And if anything were learned from the whole case, it was that we stood up for what we believed in and showed that it was not necessary to make a separation between a secular activity and a religious belief. So it didn't appear in the Yeshiva's yearbook, but the academy lets you in on a very curious incident which took place during the season. So what I want to do for the balance of our discussion is look at a case which eventually appears before the Second Appeals Court in federal court. Menorah versus Illinois High School Association legal complaint, February 1981. All of this is found in the American Jewish Historical Society, the American Jewish Congress papers, but here are the bullet points. On or about February 5th, 1981, HTC's coach, Sheldon Chaplin, just sadly passed away a number of years ago, heard a rumor that 3 years ago, the wearing of yarmulkes was challenged at the state regional tournament held in Harvard, Illinois. Coach Schaffel then contacted the Harvard basketball coach and tournament manager of the Harvard regional, who told Coach Schaffel that he did not object to the HTC Yeshiva team wearing yarmulkes, but that HTC should contact the IHSA. Okay. So in 1981, the Yeshiva finally, after a number of years, finally had a basketball team that was invited as a private school to a state tournament. They had never done this before. And so Sheldon Schaffel wanted to make sure that his boys, his young men, could wear their yarmulkes. And here they are wearing their yarmulkes on the pictures above. He wanted to make sure that before they take that several-hour trip to Harvard, Illinois, that they know for certain if they're allowed to wear, to don yarmulkes while playing ball, while playing basketball. So he had reached out to some officials, and they said, well, it's never come up before. We've never heard of it before, but you may want to check. So this was something of a self-inflicted wound. I wonder, nobody knows if he hadn't asked what would have been the case. HTC Yeshiva contacted IHSA, which is a private organization. It's its own nonprofit. It's not controlled by the state of Illinois. But still oversees all public and private school basketball tournaments in the state. First by telephone and then a letter dated February 12th, so about a week after Schaffel made that original inquiry, 1981, requesting clarification of the yarmulke issue. Defendant IHSA, they were being sued, so they're the defendant. In a letter dated February 18th, 1981, so they responded about six days later, and received by HTC Yeshiva on Friday, February 20th, 1981, came 2 days later, stating that students will not be allowed to participate in the regional tournament wearing yarmulkes. So to his chagrin, Schaffel, who had introduced the question in the first place, found out the IHSA, when they were asked, can our boys wear yarmulkes at the regional tournament? Eventually, 2 weeks later, they got the answer, no, they are not permitted. Now, here are the letters. February 12th, Dear Mr. Robinson on the right, from Rabbi Jerry Eisenberg. Dear Mr. Robinson, Yeshiva High School certainly appreciates the invitation to participate in the upcoming regional tournament. This is one matter, however, which we feel we must clarify before we can participate. Wearing skull caps, yarmulkes, by male students of the Jewish faith is a fundamental policy of our religion. Please be assured that the skull caps are securely fastened and should not cause any problems. Your cooperation and understanding is greatly appreciated. Salute yours, Rabbi Gerald Eisenberg. To the left, by February 18th, Dear Rabbi Eisenberg, I am in receipt of your correspondence dated February 12, 1981, the letter on the right, requesting permission for your student athletes to participate in the IHSA Boys Regional Tournament wearing skull caps. It is the opinion of the IHSA that skull caps securely fastened would be a violation of a 1981 National Federation Rule 2-2, and we cannot waive the rule. I must inform you that students may not be allowed to participate wearing skull caps. If I may further clarify our position, please feel free to contact me. They weren't allowed. What is Rule 2-2? So here it is from the rule book. The referee shall not permit any player to wear equipment, which in his or her judgment is dangerous to other players. Elbow, hand, finger, wrist, and or forearm guards, cast or brace made of hard or an unyielding leather, plaster, pliable soft, plastic, metal, or any hard substance, even though covered with soft padding, shall always be declared illegal. Head decorations, headwear, or jewelry are illegal. Barrettes made of soft metal are legal. Headbands no wider than 2 inches made of non-abrasive, unadorned, single-color cloth, fiber, soft leather, pliable plastic, or rubber are legal. So the question is a barrette, is a yarmulke, like a barrette, made of soft metal are legal? Or are they something different? The yeshiva and then the academy, who would sue as well, they were invited to the tournament too, argue that they are no different and there should be an allowance based on Rule 2-2. Well, yarmulke's okay, reported the Chicago Tribune in February 1981. Five players from the Yeshiva High School of the Theological College in Skokie and the Ida Crown Jewish Academy in Chicago brought a lawsuit challenging, they ordered an emergency injunction, an IHSA rule banning the wearing of headgear during basketball games. U.S. District Judge, having a Jewish fellow, Milton I. Shader, agreed Monday to issue a restraining order following a short hearing and ordered attorneys for both sides to return to court Wednesday if both teams have won their Class A regional contest and move into the finals. Yeshiva, however, was blown out by host school Harvard 99-50. Monday night, Ida Crown is scheduled to play St. Gregory's. They also got trounced. So they lost. Hence that caption in the yearbook that they, from the academy, that they lost on the court but won in the court. So Milton I. Shader rules emergency injunction. The students run. Shlomo Menorah, who was one of the, was the captain of the Shiva team, tells it with a great fanfare about how they ran it. And they got the emergency injunction. And backed by the American Jewish Congress, eventually, we'll see this in a little bit, they were allowed to play. And Judge Shader said, well, if you win, come back and we'll sort this out for the next round. Unfortunately, both Academy and Yeshiva lost, but the issue would continue about wearing a yarmulke in public spaces and wearing it playing ball. So that's where this becomes, if not already interesting, to me, super interesting. Because what was at stake was really attached draws from Rabbi Lamb's sermon from 1970. They weren't aware of it, certainly, but the same idea is that we as Americans, as high school kids, have a right to play ball. And we have a duty, apparently, to play ball wearing yarmulkes. There shall be no conflict between engaging in authentic American experience like basketball. Remember, this is the town that would eventually, 2 years later, welcome Michael Jordan. That Bulls were not very good in 81. But DePaul was. But the right to play ball and the right to wear a yarmulke, the responsibility to wear a yarmulke, were, should not be in tension with one another. That's what they viewed as at stake. Norman Krupnik, submits an affidavit. I am currently and have been for past many years the IHSA conference assignment chairman. So he works for IHSA, an assignment chairman. He's an official for IHSA. I refereed innumerable basketball games where the players were wearing yarmulkes, even though they hadn't been invited to the playoff before. This was the referee who would staff the games that the Shiva and the Academy would play. So he's an expert on the following. During all my years as a referee and assignment chairman, I have never witnessed an injury caused by a yarmulke worn during a basketball game, nor by the bobby pins or clips used to attach the yarmulkes to the players' heads. I have never heard of such an injury, nor have I received any complaints concerning the wearing of yarmulkes during basketball play. So, yarmulke is a safe piece of headgear. I have never seen anybody slip on a fallen yarmulke. in a bobby pin poking somebody in the eye. In fact, there's another affidavit. Maybe I'll add it in if I speak about this again. From the head of the Yeshiva League, Yeshiva in Chicago, Yeshiva in New York, the Yeshiva League in New York also testifying that there has never been an injury in the New York basketball scene as well. Chicago Tribune reports after they lose the game through the Yeshiva and the Academy, but here is Oscar Fossman, former head of the Yeshiva of HTC. Rabbis hit IHSA on Yarmulke rule, the issue of whether Orthodox Jewish basketball players will be allowed to wear skull caps in games sanctioned by the Illinois High School Association is not over, although both teams involved have ended their season. Rabbi Oscar Z. Fossman, president of the Associated Talmud Torahs, very basically superintendent of all the day schools, a group of Orthodox Jewish schools, said his organization will try to explain the religious significance of wearing a head cover in the hope the IHSA will change the rules. So they took it very seriously. This fellow, LL Ostroth, IHSA executive secretary, said the rule may be subject to review, but currently says this is the rule book. The rule prohibits wearing a head decoration. He quotes what I just read to you before from the rule book itself. Rabbi Fossman explained, lower down over here, that the skull caps, known as yarmulkes, are a symbol of reverence that must be worn by Orthodox Jews. The Orthodox Jew, male, at all times acknowledges that he bears the yoke of the Almighty. The skull cap is that declaration of being servants unto the Lord, he said. Then, continuing on, Rabbi Fossman maintained that there has never been a skull cap related accident. He knew as well as anybody, nobody's ever gotten hurt, broken a leg, tripped over a fallen kippah or a protruding bobby pin. But what's interesting is that the yarmulke is taking on sizable importance. It's not, they're not debating Shulchan Aruch versus the Ramah over here anymore. What's happened, and it's not a lie, I please don't misunderstand, Rabbi Fossman knows the halacha, but the kippah has taken on this outsized importance from actual textual evidence, and it represents Jewish identity. A little bit, he was a pulpit rabbi too. So was there a bit of sermonics there in the role of the yarmulke and the Yirat Shemayim? Oh, certainly. But it's not a fib. For Orthodox Jews, the kippah is an integral part of their Jewish identity. To not wear one is to surrender their identity politics, quite literally. Here's Judge Shader in his decision. So he's the one who puts the restraining order, and then the case is continued. That was, we said, in February when the playoff was to begin. The court case continues. The decision is handed down November 17th, 1981. So it continues all the way into the next academic year. What does Shader rule? Any prohibition on yeshivas and academies' ability to participate in IHSA interscholastic basketball would have a material negative impact on the schools and upon their students generally, both apart from and in addition to the negative impact on members of plaintiff, that being the yeshiva and the academy, the two day schools, class. Playing of interscholastic basketball, this is a federal judge, by yeshiva and academy represents to the community at large, Jews and non-Jews, that those schools are real schools. You're not a real school, says Judge Shader, unless you play ball, that participate in the mainstream of American life. I'll read it again without interruption. Playing of interscholastic basketball by Yeshiva and Academy represents to the community at large that those schools are real schools that participate in the mainstream of American life. Such interscholastic play gives the schools and their student body a sense of normality, self-worth, and achievement, and provides a special outlet for the students' physical and mental needs. IHSA's Robinson confirmed that loss of the opportunity to participate in interscholastic activity would represent a great loss to the students. And in recent time, I know in Maimonides School in Boston made a similar case about mock trial and Model UN. Other schools about playing about playoffs being scheduled on Shabbat, on Shabbos, is a similar issue, but we're going to focus on the Yarmulke. Now, there was a later case, a much more famous case, about wearing yarmulkes in the Air Force that went to the Supreme Court, and they ruled that more important than religious freedom is uniformity in the Army. And I should point that out, that the kippah did lose eventually in the Supreme Court, but in this case does not make it to the Supreme Court. So in the appellate court, I meant the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. The judges rule ordinarily a yarmulke just perches on the head. The bobby pins, so the Illinois High School Association appeals the decision of Judge Shader, and this comes out in June 1982. So another basically 7 months after that. The bobby pins are an acknowledgement of the yarmulke's instability on a bobbing head. So here the judge rules, wait a second. If a kippah's not gonna fall, then why do you wear clips? Why do you wear bobby pins? It must be that it's unstable without it. But bobby pins are not a secure method of fastening. Yarmulkes fastened by them fall off in the heat of play and with some frequency. Kippah falls off, toss it out. Toss it to the side. While we are not Talmudic scholars, we are reasonably confident, and the plaintiff's counsel acknowledged at oral arguments, that the precise nature of the head covering and the method by which it is kept on the head are not specified by Jewish law. There's no din in Shulchan Aruch. There's no halacha about bobby pins or clips. We put the burden of proposing an alternative, more secure method of covering the head on the plaintiffs rather than on the defendants, because the plaintiffs know so much more about Jewish law. Not the basketball officials' role to delineate what is a good method of how to secure a kippah onto somebody's head. Let the Orthodox Jews, who are much more expert in donning yarmulkes, figure out the best way to secure it so that it never falls off. And so the Seventh Court of Appeals overrules Judge Shader. Now, that judge is Richard Posner, who is nominated, I believe, he's on a short list for a very long time in the Supreme Court. He has what the Wall Street Journal reported in 1984 as the economic school of law, where he puts the burden of proof based on who is the most expert person. And here, I won't go through all of it, but here is a write-up of Judge Posner's, Justice Posner's philosophy of law. He also taught in a number of law schools, including, I believe, University of Chicago. But this was his way. This was his method. He was also Jewish. Shader and Posner were. Where he put the burden of proof not on on who was causing the commotion, but who was more expert. So this wasn't any act of anti-Semitism. I wanted to dispel any possibility. But it was actually fit, and the case in the Wall Street Journal has brought up the issue of the yarmulkes. But few have carried it as far as Judge Posner. In a June 1982 decision, he conducted a cost-benefit analysis of a rule that prohibited a high school student, that's our case, from playing basketball while wearing a yarmulke, a cap worn by some Jews, pinned on with a bobby pin. The safety costs outweighed the interest of the student, Judge Posner concluded. So with Sylvia Neal being the expert for the American Jewish Congress that was supporting the case, because it became a Jewish liberties type of case. In a letter she writes in March 1983, so again, if we just keep our chronology together, Judge Posner in the Seventh Court of Appeals overruled Shader in June 1982. By March 83, so 9 months later, Come and Gone is is an attempt to have this case appealed once further now by the plaintiff in the Supreme Court. Sylvie Neal of the American Jewish Congress writes, upon the Supreme Court's denial of our petition, we discussed the possibilities of alternate types of head coverings, including those alluded to by Judge Posner in his opinion. It's up where we have the burden of proof to demonstrate a safe yarmulke. You both strongly expressed your beliefs that the boys on your basketball teams could not be forced to wear bizarre head coverings. We don't have the renderings. What while playing basketball, because requiring such attire may be in conflict with Jewish law. Indeed, you said that you would rather, in all likelihood, pull your teams from the IHSA if such headwear was required. The only alternative acceptable to you that we discussed was securing the yarmulkes with so-called Israeli clips. Okay, now we're getting into the weeds. It's fun in the weeds. So they actually commissioned an engineer named Willis, who conducted an experiment. I have completed a series of tests. Can't make this stuff up. On the yarmulke retaining clips that have been provided to me, and based upon these tests, I have determined that the contour clip, the so-called Israeli clip, appears to be a superior fastening device to the simple bobby pin for purposes of holding a yarmulke to the head. A brief outline of the test protocol and results is shown below. So this fellow, Dr. Willis, conducted an experiment and did the following. It's quite thorough. Looked at the securing capacity of various fastening devices on various types of head. So, for example, calculated the amount of force needed to remove these with a bobby pin. A contour clip, which is coming down silver and black. I'm wearing one, happens to be, with a contour clip, with a silk yarmulke, with a bobby pin, with a contour clip, wool yarmulke, and did similar tests based on oily and non-oily hair. Finally, in March 23rd, 1983, Sylvie Neal writes to the two heads of the Yeshiva and the Academy, I just want to outline for you the current status of the above case and to review some of our discussions concerning where we go from here. Despite the setbacks to the appellate courts that Judge Posner's opinion and Supreme Court's refusal to grant interlocutory review, our position is much better than we went to court 2 years ago. In light of the appellate court opinion, IHSA's posture has changed from absolute prohibition of all headwear to other than what we expressly mentioned in its rules, to considering alternative forms of headwear which comply with its concerns. Upon the Supreme Court's denial of our petition, we discussed the possibilities of alternative types of head coverings, including those alluded to Judge Posner. You both strongly expressed, we read this before, we shared your concern with the attorney for IHSA and proposed to them in the second paragraph the alternative of Israeli clips. The IHSA has taken our proposal under consideration. In the interim, as you know, they agreed to not prevent your students from playing interscholastic basketball while wearing yarmulkes attached with bobby pins. Since neither David nor I, as American Jewish Congress staff member, received complaints, we assumed that the basketball season went forward with no incident as the head coverings. And finally, because this is the way that the justice system works, Posner sent it back to the local courts, back to Judge Shader, who ruled positively for the Yeshiva and the Academy back in 1981, twice. A federal judge signed an order Tuesday enabling students at Ida Crown Jewish Academy and the Hebrew Theological College Preparatory School, because they had a rabbinical program as well, while playing interscholastic basketball. The order signed by U.S. District Judge Milton I. Shader requires the players to secure the yarmulkes with Israeli clips. I should also mention is that IHSA actually asked, because Shader was Jewish, to recuse himself, and he refused. The clips, which will be sewn in the yarmulkes, which is actually now a fad for yarmulkes, are metal clasps used to attach the skull caps to the head, meaning they inserted, this is maybe the first idea of inserting the Israeli contour clips into the yarmulke. The order culminates a two-year legal battle that began in 1981 when the Illinois High School Association, which regulates interscholastic athletics, prohibited Orthodox Jewish basketball players from wearing yarmulkes during play. The American Jewish Congress filed suit on behalf of the two schools, claiming the IHSA ban violated students' First Amendment rights of religious freedom. Orthodox Jewish males are required to keep their heads covered at all times. We are very pleased that we have successfully ensured that these boys will not be forced to stop playing in Scholastic basketball because of their religious beliefs, said David Gross, who, with Sylvia Neal, filed the suit. Shader had ruled the use of bobby pins or clips to secure the yarmulkes was satisfactory, satisfied Justice Posner in the Seventh Appeals Court. And the IHSA's safety objections were speculative. Decision was appealed, and the U.S. Court of Appeals returned the case to Shader for further hearings, resulting in the agreed order. So here, before we depart, this is a so-called Israeli contour clip. Having worked at the yeshiva and having grown up a little bit in Chicago, I dutifully wear my contour clip when I'm playing ball or not. In any case, what this shows is the extent to which the Orthodox Jewish community went to secure their God-given right to wear a yarmulke and play basketball simultaneously. It was inconceivable to them that they couldn't do both at the same time. They had the right as Americans in that post-67 world. American Jews, you know, this is a test case in Orthodox Judaism. Like it's, you could extend it further and say that in this post-67 period, it was incommensurate for Jews in the United States to believe that they couldn't have it all. And in this humorous, maybe not high-stakes case, they weren't that good after all. They got trounced by Harvard, Illinois. Nevertheless, it was inconceivable that they shouldn't be allowed to play ball and to show off their Jewish identity simultaneously. That was their right as both Jews and as Americans. Well, thank you so much, everybody. Any questions, comments, rebuttals? Anybody a descendant of Richard Posner? No?
There's some comments in the chat if you want to look at them.
Oh, of course, of course. interesting question about when the Cordoba Rambam statue, well known, was constructed. I don't know the answer to that. Wikipedia might, but I don't know it off the top of my head. A couple of questions about the Syrian community related to me and their community. Only the rabbis wear kippahs. Right. So I think that even they've departed from Shulchan Aruch to some degree or another. And it's an interesting case of when Larry Grossman wrote an article in a volume honoring Yitz Greenberg about the yarmulke that I this is a chapter in my book, Authentically Orthodox. A little bit. I made it a little more playful this time in speaking. But Larry's article is really important. When Maimonides School honored the Rav in the annual dinner in the 1980s, quote of the Rav on the front of the invitation read, so this is from Tammy, like this: it's incumbent on modern man to meet the world with a kippah on and head in on head and gemara in the hand. I would love to see that. I would love, love, love. Of course.
I actually have it at home.
You do?
But I'm not at home now, so.
Oh, so please, if you can take a screenshot and share it. Unfortunately, I found it just the other day that I taught at Maimonides School for a number of years while I was in graduate school. Didn't know that it would cost so much to live in Brookline. And so I taught in MIMO, as it's known. And, Mike Rosenberg was very sweet, very nice. He just passed away. He was the head of alumni affairs, among other things. And he would have been the person I would go to. So I'd love to see that. Right. And then, Mark, thanks. Had he been Jewish and released the study on Purim, this would have been fit, right? The last week's lecture. A little bit of Purim Torah, but serious. Like, that's what's funny. It's a funny case, but you can tell the stakes. I mean, this was hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees, and they're willing to go all the way to the Supreme Court. So while it's kind of humorous, these kids weren't all that good at basketball, but for them, the stakes were really high. I like to do that. Take something funny, but, it's something of low import, perhaps on one level, but actually the stakes were quite high. And the fact that they actually deigned to bring this before the highest courts in the United States was a big deal. Yeah, but Mark, thanks for sharing.
I'll take back a comment.
Please, please.
Okay, in 1953, I appeared in traffic court in New York City, and I wore a yarmulke. And when I approached the judge, he said I should have to take that yarmulke off or I'll be held in contempt of court.
Wow.
And that's a real maisa shehoyu. So it shows you how the law was held against us for wearing yarmulkes, and it probably had to do more with anti-Semitism than with anything else. I once walked into a, I think it was a Howard Johnson's with a yarmulke, and I was told I'd have to leave if I was going to continue to wear the yarmulke.
Mm.
Because their rules were you cannot wear a yarmulke in a public place, and on and on and on. So wearing a yarmulke back in the 50s was a dangerous thing. And we didn't. We had to remove the yarmulke. On the other hand, I once walked into a service in a reform shul with a yarmulke, and once again they showed me the door because I could not be in a reform synagogue wearing a yarmulke in the 50s. So there we go.
No, it's a very serious thing, no question. Obviously, your case sounds much more painful than that. I am told that the star point guard in 1983, because, you know, high school students come and go. And so by 83 or 84, one of the boys, Sheldon Schaffel, was still the coach of the yeshiva team. And during a scrimmage, during a practice, the boy flung his yarmulke to the side and Schaffel excoriated him, saying, "Do you know what your ancestors had to endure in order for the right to wear a yarmulke? You put that back on your head," which is really important. Okay. So again, same bad time, same bad channel, as Adam West would say. And I think next week is a little more serious. We're going to talk about, the mechanisms, the rabbinic mechanisms in the United States to help, solve the most miserable, case of a gunot in the United States and the levers that were pulled. So maybe a little less comedy next time. Got our doses for the last three weeks. Anyway, hope everybody have a wonderful rest of your week. Bye-bye.